Welcome to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open-access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. As Stem Cell Reports embarks on its second decade of publishing impactful science across the breadth of stem cell research, this podcast will look at highlights from the latest advances published in the journal. We'll be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the personalities behind the work. Thanks for listening in. Since the 1930s, research using human fetal tissue has been responsible for numerous scientific and medical advances that have saved millions of lives, including the development of vaccines and treatments for many diseases. Despite its very substantial contribution to medicine and science, significant public debate and indeed misinformation persists surrounding the ethical use of human fetal tissue in biomedical research. The ISSCR, led by its Public Policy Committee, have been tireless champions and advocates for sound science policy across the globe. This includes advocacy for human fetal tissue research and longstanding efforts to inform policymakers and the public on the vast medical applications and advances that have and will come from the use of human fetal tissue in biomedical research. Towards that end, the ISSCR and the Lawrence Goldstein Policy Fellows have authored a recent paper in Stem Cell Reports entitled Human Fetal Tissue is Critical for Biomedical Research. My guests on today's podcast are Lawrence Goldstein, Tyler Lamb, Tamara Lysott, and Justin Brumbaugh. Larry Goldstein is a distinguished professor emeritus in the Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine and Director Emeritus of the Stem Cell Program, both at the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Goldstein's laboratory studies molecular transport pathways and their impact on neurodegenerative disorders, such as Alzheimer's disease. Larry is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and has a longstanding and impactful history of science policy advocacy, which includes serving on the ISSCR's Public Policy Committee. Larry has received the Public Service Award from the American Society for Cell Biology and is the namesake for the ISSCR's Lawrence Goldstein Science Policy Fellowship, which is aimed at training the next generation of scientists to impact public policy. Tyler Lamb is the ISSCR's Director of Policy, and he leads the Society's global policy efforts, including support for stem cell research, funding for research, and facilitating scientifically informed regulatory decision-making. Tamara Lysott is an associate professor in health ethics at the University of Sydney in Australia. Tamara studies bioethics and policy-relevant issues in emerging bioscience and health technologies, with an emphasis in stem cells and regenerative medicine. Dr. Lysott is an ISSCR Lawrence Goldstein Science Policy Fellow. And lastly, Justin Brumbaugh is an assistant professor in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His research leverages stem cells and induced cell fate change to study early development with a focus on epigenetics and post-transcriptional regulation. Dr. Brumbaugh is also an ISSCR Lawrence Goldstein Policy Fellow. Drs. Brumbaugh, Lysott, and Goldstein, along with Brian Aguado, are authors of the recently published paper, Human Fetal Tissue is Critical for Biomedical Research. Welcome to you all, and thanks for being here. Larry, you've been a successful scientist, and you've received many prestigious awards over the years for your research in molecular motors and the role of transport pathways in neurodegenerative disease. But you've also established yourself as an expert in science policy at the local, state, and national levels. I'm sure our listeners would be interested to know how your involvement in science advocacy began.
Yeah, it began rather innocently. To be honest, it was the early 90s. I had just received tenure at Harvard, and I thought, well, I have an established position now. I can devote part of my efforts to service. And the question was, what kind of service should I do at the time? Study sections, editorial boards. There are lots of outlets for scientists to serve the community. But at the time, something that was extremely underpopulated were scientists willing to engage with local state and national governments, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. And so I figured if you're going to do something where there aren't enough people. And so I decided to work in that area. And as we say, it snowballed.
Okay, well, this brings us to a kind of obvious but a very important question for audience. And that's why do scientists need to be involved in science advocacy and policymaking?
You know, the simplest possible answer to that question is if scientists don't become involved in the regulation and funding of science, politicians will do it for us. And I'm just not sure that we're going to like the outcome of that particular avenue. So we, as a community, we must be involved in all nations, states in the U.S., different levels. And ultimately, it's an extension of engaging with the public to be sure that folks that live next door to you in your neighborhood know something about what you do and why it's important. That's necessary for the vitality and viability of our community and for science itself.
We certainly need to teach our young scientists what an important job this really is. It's a big part of their role. Justin, like Larry, you're a research scientist and you use stem cells to study cell fate regulation. Tell us a little bit about your background in research and how you became interested in advocacy.
Yeah, sure. So I have a varied research background, but my interest in stem cells really crystallized when I was in grad school. I focused on mass spectrometry and proteomics, and applying those analytical techniques to study stem cell biology was completely open at the time. And right around the same time, induced pluripotent stem cells were reported for the first time, and that really captured my attention and then drove a lot of my postdoctoral work. So I started my independent lab about 5 years ago. And we work in all aspects of cell fate, but our core is understanding sort of the mechanistic details that underlie differentiation and regeneration. As for my interest in public policy, so I had inspiration perhaps from some unexpected places. In between my undergrad time and my grad school work, I worked for a while in Germany. And so to help learn the language, I was reading German texts. And I stumbled on a play called The Physicists. And the play itself is sort of tongue-in-cheek and has a complicated plot line, but it more or less revolves around the responsibility that we have as scientists for our creations. And so Albert Einstein and the atomic bomb are heavily featured, for example, and that concept resonated with me. And so if I'm going to be involved in science and innovation, I want to be part of the conversation around this regulation. And I'd also just real quickly, like to mention Harry Kroto. I had the great privilege of meeting him a few times. He won a Nobel Prize for Buckminster Fullerenes, but was also a staunch advocate for science. And I really admired his efforts, and I try to emulate his approach. So in a nutshell, that's part of my motivation.
That's a great source of inspiration. Can I ask you if you've seen Oppenheimer?
I've not seen the movie. No, I want to, but haven't managed yet.
I recommend it to you. It's a little bit about science policy, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Well, and the book actually is also terrific. Excellent read.
Yeah.
So, Tamara, you're kind of unique compared to our other guests. First of all, you're Australian scientist, which is great. But also you're a specialist in science policy and bioethics and their applications to the governance of biomedical research and regenerative medicine. So what sparked your interest to make a career out of this direction? And how do you go about approaching this from an academic perspective?
All right. Thanks, Martin. Yes, like many people in bioethics, academic bioethics, I fell into it. I was on a trajectory to I was studying biotechnology and I was very, very interested in the work that was emerging around stem cell research and stem cell biology. And I happened to meet scientists who were setting up the National Stem Cell Center at the time with Commonwealth funding. And that was Alan Transon and Graham Jenkins, and they encouraged me to do a PhD, something in the area of ethics of stem cells. And so I applied and won that scholarship and ended up my dissertation focused on documented the role that science plays in debates that are inherently political and moral, and just highlighted the power that a good scientific argument can play in that, but also that it is deeply entwined with the politics ethics. And I guess emphasizes the importance for scientists to sort of open their vocabulary and intellectual range to be able to engage not just in arguing over scientific facts, but engaging with those essential moral and political debates that are underlying the science policy issues. And from there, I just got offered a postdoc at the National University of Singapore, and the rest is history.
Terrific. Yeah, I know a little bit about the early days of the debates around stem cells in Australia. That was my particular baptism by fire into this area. Tyler, you're kind of unusual as well in that you've got a legal background and you've spent many years with health and scientific organizations overseeing science policy advocacy. So tell us about how the ISSCR works to impact science policy, and also maybe tell us a little bit about the Goldstein Fellows Program.
Yeah, thank you for the questions, Martin, and thank you for including me today. So the ISSCR's policy work is underscored by ISSCR's guidelines for stem cell research and clinical translation. Almost every issue ISSCR engages on is addressed in those guidelines. And this is wonderful because it ensures that our advocacy work has a solid foundation. You have thoroughly vetted, carefully crafted recommendations developed and approved by our global membership. To assist with interpreting and applying the guidelines, we have three committees that the policy department oversees, for which I'm staff liaison. The first is our public policy committee, and it leans more legislative in focus and provides input on issues like this one under discussion today, but also other issues like the marketing of unapproved cellular therapies and research with stem cell-based embryo models. Our manufacturing, clinical translation, and regulatory committee, as the name suggests, has a more translational focus and is assisting with moving stem cell science from the bench to the clinic. This committee hosts meetings with regulators around the globe and also provides written input to regulators via responses to agency requests for information and guidances. And lastly, we have ISSCR's ethics committee. This committee assists in addressing and navigating ethical issues that arise in some areas of stem cell research. Committee members provide guidance and oversight to a lot of the policy work that we do, especially the public policy committee. And to answer your second question, the Goldstein Fellows Program is an ISSCR fellowship program that honors ISSCR member and fellow podcast participant Larry Goldstein for his longstanding commitment to policy and public service. And the policy fellowship program continues that legacy by training ISSCR members to become policy advocates on issues like this one.
Thanks, Tyler. And I'll just take a moment to acknowledge the fantastic work that you and your colleagues at ISSCR doing, supporting these efforts and helping to drive them forward. It really is an enormous service to the field, and we appreciate it. I don't know how you do all the things you do, but you must be very busy. So this the specific policy issue we're discussing today is human fetal tissue research. Fetal tissue has been used in studies since the 1930s, and despite its significant impact on human health, its use and the laboratories using it, indeed, are routinely subject to politically motivated roadblocks that undermine progress. Can I ask you, Larry, where does this opposition come from? And is this opposition most active in the United States, or is it an issue in many jurisdictions?
Yeah, I don't have firsthand knowledge of how sensitive this is outside the U.S., although I would bet that in Germany and any other Catholic country, it is a hot issue. There really are, as near as I can tell, and Tamara certainly should weigh in here, but there is the religious objections, where those who are morally opposed to abortion because of religious reasons regard fetal tissue as tainted if it was an induced abortion and therefore morally suspect. There is also, I think, a suspicion that the ability to use the tissue for something valuable may help persuade women who are carrying unwanted pregnancies. It may help persuade them to abort. I don't know that we have any real firsthand data on that. And then, you know, I think the other issue that arises is, you know, a country like Germany with a complicated past is very skittish about any use of human tissue that might be regarded as, you know, the instrumentalization of human life. You know, in a nutshell, it's a combination of moral objections and religious objections in my experience. But it's interesting to hear what Tamara says, because I'm not clear entirely on what goes on outside the U.S., of course.
Tamara, maybe you could pitch in on this. Certainly there was a minority but very strong objection to the use of embryo research in Australia at one stage. Maybe you give us an update on how things are down there now.
I've only just returned to Australia after living in Southeast Asia, of Singapore, for 14 years. I have been kind of keeping watch out with the emergence of the new embryo models to sort of see what kind of response those church leaders have historically raise objections towards embryonic stem cell research. And I've been quite surprised that it's all been very quiet. And I'm not sure if it just means that there isn't much issue or if they've just now moved on to with other concerns that have been issues that have been plaguing the church over these last decades. But certainly from the standpoint from fetal tissue research, I don't see the same sort of objections that were raised towards human embryo research, and in particular with the proposal to create embryos for this specific purpose of research for fetal tissues that, of course, would never be tolerated. And there is very well regulated guidelines in Australia and Singapore and elsewhere that put the focus on ensuring that the donor provides the tissue with informed consent, and that any decision to donate the tissue waste is separated completely from any decision to terminate a pregnancy. That decision is and should always be made between the patient and her treating physician. I can't talk about specific laws and regulations because there are so many different regulatory structures in different jurisdictions. It's very difficult to generalize, but I don't I'm sure there are a few minority voices out there who would have a problem with it, but living in a pluralistic democratic society, those voices can be acknowledged, but that is not how we construct our science policy here.
Well, that's encouraging to hear, and you make a couple important points. First, about the embryo models, and it's interesting they haven't raised much controversy yet. Outside of our own field. And secondly, the very important point that, of course, fetal tissue research is subject to very stringent regulations and oversights, which we all have to remember. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll continue our discussion.
Stem Cell Reports is ISSCR's open access, peer-reviewed society journal for scientists by scientists. The journal publishes research and commentaries that drive the field of stem cell science forward.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. We've been talking with Larry Goldstein, Tamara Lysott, Justin Brumbaugh, and Tyler Lamb about science policy advocacy and their recent paper on the use of human fetal tissue in research. Now, Justin, in your paper, I've got to say, you all did a wonderful job highlighting four key uses of human fetal tissue. So maybe you could tell us what these important usages are and why they're so significant. And secondly, it's true that opponents of the research often point to alternatives for human tissue. And to what extent are there viable alternatives that can be used?
Yeah, thanks for the question. It was extremely difficult, I'll say, to narrow down the uses for fetal tissue research to something that was manageable for the paper. And with that said, we felt it was also important to have a very concise perspective on the uses, mainly because there's a common misconception in the discourse around fetal tissue that it's not been effective in advancing science. And that simply isn't true. So the first point is that human fetal tissue serves as a gold standard for comparison with other model systems. And for example, you know, stem cells hold enormous potential because in principle, they can be directed to specific tissues and cell types for lots of different applications. So regenerative medicine, disease modeling, and drug testing. But to use these stem cell-derived systems, you really have to validate that they accurately reflect their in vivo counterparts. And human fetal tissue is absolutely crucial as a comparator in that regard. And then second, human fetal tissue is important in studying human development and disease. And so it offers a source of material from what I would call an authentic developmental context, and is relevant in cases where other models break down. And so a good example here involves the study of diabetes. So generating functional islet cells from stem cells has at least historically been kind of challenging. And insulin-producing cells from the adult pancreas don't self-renew long-term. And so as a result, having access to insulin-producing cells from human fetal tissue has been essential in studying diabetes. The third point might seem a little more nuanced, but human fetal tissue is absolutely crucial for generating humanized mouse models. And so these are mice whose hematopoietic systems are effectively replaced by human cells. And that means that we can study many aspects of the human immune system in an in vivo context that otherwise simply wouldn't be possible. And this is particularly important, for example, in studying HIV, because other model systems, like primates, for example, are not susceptible to the virus. And then the final point is that human fetal tissue has been instrumental in the development and production of vaccines, all the way from polio to COVID-19. And it's much easier to link that research that uses human fetal tissue, in this case, to human lives saved. I saw one estimate that between 1960 and 2015, immunization saved something like 10.5 million lives and prevented 4.5 billion cases of disease. It's easy to appreciate the value of this application, given our recent experience with COVID-19. And then as for alternatives, some do exist. So for example, stem cell-based models and organoids are really very important in a variety of applications. In the same breath, I want to emphasize that in most cases, research has not established that the alternatives have all of the necessary properties to fully replace the human fetal tissue. And I'll just give one quick example. It's actually possible to make humanized mouse models from perinatal tissues. And this does work for some applications, but these models can't be used to study the maturation of fetal T cells because the hematopoietic cells are already at a later developmental time point. Yeah, so the ability to use human fetal tissue for the humanized mice remains really important. And one last thing that I want to add before I forget is that although vaccines often are maybe developed and produced in cells derived from human fetal tissues, the end product does not contain in any human fetal tissue. That's a very important point to note.
Thank you, Justin. Your point about the mice with humanized immune systems is a very important one. At the JAKS, these are some of the most important models we produce for the scientific community. And their development, we're constantly trying to refine them. And their development really is critically dependent on having the right starting materials. And they're finding increasing use in, you know, new assessment of immunotherapies, cell therapies, et cetera. So it's a really, thank you for pointing that out. Tamara, so getting back to an issue we were beginning to touch on, what are some of the ethical and regulatory considerations for use of fetal tissue? And in your opinion, is most fetal tissue research conducted in accordance with high ethical standards?
Well, I've certainly never seen any evidence to suggest that there are any deviations from either formal regulatory mechanisms that are in place that govern the procurement and use of fetal tissue anywhere in the world, or even that it is not conforming to the ethical standards that have been set by the International Stem Cell Society's guidelines.
Thanks. Tyler, as far as fetal tissue use, are there current efforts in the U.S. or elsewhere to promote legislation that might jeopardize this research?
Yes. In the U.S., this is a particularly contentious issue and has been for some time. As others have mentioned, because fetal tissue can be obtained from a terminated pregnancy, there are constituencies that are opposed to federal funding of this research. And during Trump's presidency, these groups were successful in convincing his administration to end intramural research with human fetal tissue at NIH and throttle NIH-funded research using human fetal tissue through the creation of an advisory board that reviewed all research proposals that use the material. The composition of this advisory board was heavily influenced by opponents of fetal tissue research. And needless to say, this board wasn't inclined to approve much during its short tenure. But thanks to ISSCR leadership on this issue and the backing of the larger biomedical research community, that board was disbanded in 2021 by President Biden. But efforts to undermine this research are still ongoing. Now, presently, there is a policy rider in the House Fiscal Year 2024 Labor HHS, so that's Health and Human Services Appropriations Bill, that would eliminate federal funding for research with human fetal tissue obtained from an induced abortion. The appropriations process for FY24 is still ongoing, despite the fiscal year beginning in October 2023. And by all accounts, it still probably has a ways to go. So whether that policy rider will be included in the final budgetary bills is up in the air. But ISSCR has continued to advocate against restrictions on HFT research. In fact, both Justin here helped with that at our annual advocacy day in DC in 2023.
Thanks. So Justin, that leads us to our next question. You and I have both been part of the past ISSCR Congressional Advocacy Day, which is certainly an interesting experience. Can you tell our audience what it's like as a scientist to engage with policymakers at the highest levels of government?
Yeah, sure. Daunting but important are the words that come to mind. I remember during the moratorium on embryonic stem cell research, there was a lot of misinformation that I heard, and I kept thinking someone has to do something about this. Having that opportunity to engage in the discourse and provide credible, accurate information is extremely important, but also personally satisfying. And I'll just say that I think you certainly need to have a long-term outlook. Often you're not entirely sure that you're moving the needle all that much. But I think even if you can simply clarify a confusing point or a topic that may be concerning to the general public, it really helps. And also just providing that information to the policymakers who then have to answer to their constituents, again, is really important.
Terrific. Yeah, I've been pleased speaking to our senators and representatives from Maine, how positive they've been around this issue and how supportive they've been. Tyler,
so just interject here, sure. Mark. You know, I think Tyler did a great job of explaining the political and legal landscape. But I think there's an important argument that our colleagues in the scientific community need to know, which is that there's no evidence that the ability to donate fetal tissue for research increases the number of women who choose to have abortions. And second, if the tissue is not used for research, it will simply be discarded. So again, the abortion is going to happen whether you like it or not in many jurisdictions. And so as I like to phrase it, you have a choice. Do something useful or throw it in the trash. End of story.
That's a really, really important point, Larry. And every time I've been involved in collecting this type of material, it's always very clear that the decision to donate is completely separate to the and distal to the decision to undergo the termination of pregnancy procedure. Thanks for noting that. Tyler, the ISSCR's policy efforts, of course, extend beyond fetal tissue research. So maybe you could highlight some of the emergency policy issues coming up on the horizon that the society and its community are focused on.
Yeah. So, for the time being, this particular issue we've been discussing is unlikely to fade, given the underlying politics around reproductive health care and the narrow margins of the parties in the House and the Senate and the incentives to those members when they run for re-election. But the field is much larger than just this issue, and there are other policy areas where we are eager to work collaboratively with policymakers, regulators, and stakeholders around the world. One exciting emerging area that you've already heard about is stem cell-based embryo models, which have the potential to help us understand early pregnancy loss and the developmental origins of congenital defects in the heart and nervous system. Recent rapid advances in this tech have created questions about how best to define these models and how they should be regulated. And ISSCR has initiatives underway to assist policymakers in answering those questions. And we've been talking about basic science research a lot. So another area that I'll highlight is the scaling up and scaling out of cell therapies. So can we ID pain points in the process of developing pluripotent stem cell therapies that, if solved or mitigated, would accelerate the development of cell-based therapies for patients in need? Issues with cell line selection, genomic instability of cell populations, understanding host immune responses, these are all areas of concern that our Manufacturing Clinical Translation and Regulatory Committee is working to address on behalf of our membership and regulators. And lastly, to those interested in assisting with ISSCR's policy work, I encourage you to apply for the Goldstein Fellowship. It just so happens that we'll be opening applications very soon, most likely March of this year. Just some basic information on the fellowship. Our fellows serve a three-year term, gaining firsthand policy and regulatory experience, and they serve as ex officio members of the Public Policy Committee. They're also invited to attend our in-person advocacy days, and they take on special initiatives like drafting this paper that we've been discussing, or helping plan policy-related initiatives at ISSCR's annual meeting. So please be on the lookout for notice about the application period opening up again this March.
Thanks, Tyler. That's a great opportunity for people who are interested in this area, and we've got some fantastic examples with us today. The point you make about manufacturing and scale up is also important to cost of goods, which touches on the accessibility of this and equitable access to these emerging technologies. So that's another very important area. Tamara, as a mentor for students and postdocs, how do you approach engagement in science advocacy with them? Very important we bring the next generation of you and the Megan Munsees along.
My academic role is actually in medical schools, and so a lot of the graduates that we teach are doctors or scientists doing medical science and biomedical science, and so they come and take our courses in bioethics. And where we try to sort of get them is to, again, widen their sort of intellectual vocabulary to be able to engage with the arguments and ideas outside of just the scientific facts. I quite often can push them and, the earlier responses are, well, look, this is what you're supposed to do. This is your job. And it's like, well, it's actually not my job. It's not my area of research that you have politicians at very high levels who want to ban it and stop funding it. So you are your best advocate in terms of, getting out there. And so not only counteracting factual inaccuracies, which do plague these types of debates, but also just coming very directly at what the moral or the ethical objections that are being made, and to counter those with sound, justified responses.
So ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for you.
That's right.
Yeah, good. Now, Larry, before I wind up with this final question, I want to take the opportunity to thank you for your advocacy work across many areas of scientific research in California and the nation. And many people, some people might not appreciate that at times this work carries real personal risks. Not many people are willing to put their head above the parapet, but you have, and your selflessness has made a real difference to the work of so many scientists and to patients who benefit from that work. So thank you. But finally, what advice would you give to early career scientists who are interested in this area?
Well, first of all, engaging with the ISSCR has a lot of avenues for sort of learning the basics of how to interact with members of the government. Ultimately, you know, in the U.S., where you have a congressional representative, this is somebody from your local community. And if you can help them understand the science that's happening in their community, you know, I happen to live in a science dense neighborhood with UCSD and the Salk and Scripps all next door and a lot of biotech. So, you know, these are activities that are vital to our congressmen. But even, you know, the members of our community who live in areas where there's not a dense biotech community, nonetheless, you know, the medical science is really important to the health of the members of that community, and issues about developing novel therapies are important. And so there's always a basis for interaction with your local representatives or, you know, members of the Senate in the U.S. is a little more complicated. But, you know, it's like talking to your neighbor, and it's a good thing for people to understand why science is so important to their welfare.
It's not just a good thing, it's essential. Thanks for those thoughts. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our audience for joining us, and thank you to our guests for sharing their stories with us today. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thanks again for listening.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research is a global scientific society that promotes excellence in stem cell science and applications to human health. Our vision is a world where stem cell science is encouraged, ethics are prioritized, and discovery improves understanding and advances human health. To join us, visit www.isscr.org/membership.